It's my honor to kick off this next event, a conversation with state Supreme Court justices. As noted in your program, we'll be hearing a bit about what is the proper role of the state judiciary when considering questions of federal law. If there are adequate and independent federal and state grounds, on which basis should a state Supreme Court decide a case? I suspect, given the caliber of our panel, we'll go well beyond that and into some very other very interesting issues, but that's a bit of a kicking off point, and Judge Sykes will have more to say about that. It is, again, my honor to warmly welcome, on behalf of the Federalist Society, our moderator, Judge Diane Sykes. I sort of feel like this is a bit superfluous because you all know who she is and are all in the same level of awe that I am, but it's my job to introduce her, so I will go into the background. Judge Sykes is a United States Circuit Court judge on the Court of Appeals for the Seventh Circuit. She earned her Bachelor of Science degree in journalism, explains why she's such a great writer, at Northwestern University, followed by her Juris Doctor at Marquette University Law School. Following school, Judge Sykes clerked for Judge Terrence Evans at the U.S. District Court for the Eastern District of Wisconsin, and then entered private practice as a litigator in Milwaukee. She won election as a trial court judge in Milwaukee in 1992 and then ascended to the Wisconsin Supreme Court in 1999. President George W. Bush appointed her to the Seventh Circuit in 2004. In one of those fun, full-circle life event moments, Judge Sykes' service on the circuit court began alongside Judge Evans, for whom she had clerked a few years prior. It is indeed a small world. Judge Sykes' tenure on the bench at all levels has been quite distinguished, but most recently, and by recently I mean like within the last 10 days, Judge Sykes issued an important Second Amendment decision striking down a number of gun range restrictions imposed by the city of Chicago, properly adhering to Supreme Court precedent in McDonald versus City of Chicago. So, again, I say on behalf of all of us, thank you, Judge Sykes, for that and for being here. And I'll turn it over to the judge.
Thank you very much. That was a very kind introduction, and I'm delighted to be here with you today. And this is an important topic, and I'm happy to be asked to return to my roots, which was state government, the state judiciary, and the state constitution. So I'm very happy to be with you today. And please do continue to eat. Finish your meal. If they bring dessert, please don't hesitate to finish your dessert. I have been a candidate for statewide office, and I have addressed many after lunch and after dinner crowds, and I am used to speaking over the clinking of silverware and glasses. So please do continue to finish your lunch, which was wonderful. It's my privilege to be here today with these two experts in state constitutional law, very distinguished members of their respective state Supreme Courts. I'm going to introduce them first and then give my own take on our subject today briefly, and then turn it over to them, and then we'll have some questions and answers afterwards. Justice Clint Bolick was appointed to the Arizona Supreme Court in January of last year, after a long and influential career as one of the leading and most successful members of the libertarian legal movement. Early in his career, he worked for future Supreme Court Justice Clarence Thomas at the EEOC. An auspicious beginning, I think. Yes. He is perhaps best known for his successful defense of school choice programs in my home state of Wisconsin, which is where I know him from and watched him work, and in the state of Ohio. He anchored the litigation teams at three prominent libertarian public interest law firms, the Landmark Center for Civil Rights, the Institute for Justice, which he co-founded with Chip Miller, and the Goldwater Institute. From his perch at each of these firms, he brought many lawsuits, large and small, to vindicate individual liberties, including long-neglected economic liberties. He has published widely on the issues of school choice, immigration, and more broadly on how the judiciary can and should more vigorously protect individual liberties. Chief Justice Stephen Markman has served on the Michigan Supreme Court since his appointment in 1999, winning statewide election in 2000 and re-election in 2004 and 2012. Before his appointment, he served on the Michigan Court of Appeals. Early in his legal career, he held important posts on Capitol Hill as chief counsel to the Senate Judiciary Committee and counsel to the Senate Subcommittee on the Constitution. During President Reagan's second term, he moved to the Justice Department, serving as Assistant Attorney General in charge of the Office of Legal Policy. Next came a term as the United States Attorney for Eastern Michigan. After leaving that office, he spent some time in private practice before entering into judicial service. In addition to his judicial duties, Chief Justice Markman teaches constitutional law at Hillsdale College and has written widely on constitutional law, federalism, and the role of the courts. Now, to today's conference topic and my own take on it briefly. Justice Brennan's new judicial federalism was, as we've been discussing so far this morning, his call to arms in state constitutionalism. The subject touches on the systemic relationship between the state and federal courts, and for me at least, raises important questions about how the state judiciaries should interpret questions or cases arising under the state constitution. By what interpretive theory or decision method should they adjudicate these cases, and which interpretive theory best conforms to the legal justification for the power of judicial review? My own views on these subject, or on this subject are influenced by my service in both court systems. And I'll say a few words first about the relationship between the state courts and the lower federal courts, on which I now serve as a member of the Seventh Circuit, and the dialogue between state and federal courts on questions of state law. The very first opinion I wrote for the Wisconsin Supreme Court involved an important question of state statutory law that had been certified to us from the Seventh Circuit Court of Appeals, the court on which I now serve. The state Supreme Court, of course, has the final and authoritative say on questions of state law, and so we always welcomed these certifications. I'm now on the other side. And as cases have come to us in a diversity during my tenure on the Seventh Circuit, and that happens with regularity, I've had occasion to certify state law questions to state Supreme Courts on perhaps a half a dozen occasions in the space of 12 and a half years. These were questions of state statutory or common law, and in each case, we were genuinely in doubt about how the state Supreme Court would resolve the question, and hence the reason for the certification. Far more commonly, however, when we're sitting in diversity, we proceed to the merits, apply the Erie Doctrine, and predict how the state Supreme Court would decide the question. Questions of state constitutional law are different. I can think of only one such case that reached us in diversity, and we tried very hard to find some alternative ground for decision, and succeeded. If that had failed, we certainly would have certified the question to the Illinois Supreme Court. It was a case out of Illinois. We just have a strong disinclination to get out in front of a state Supreme Court on the meaning of the state constitution. So this brings me back to today's topic more specifically, Justice Brennan's new federalism. Now, Chief Justice Markman and Justice Bolick are the experts and the main event here today, so I will just touch very briefly on my own views, which are largely the product of my own experience in deciding state constitutional questions during my five-year tenure as a member of the Wisconsin Supreme Court. I am, fair warning here, going to deliver a little bit of a reality check on our discussion this morning, in particular the second panel this morning, which was very enthusiastic for state education clause litigation in particular. My own experience on that topic brings me to a very different point of view than your panelists this morning, so I'll get to that in a moment. First, let me say that I completely agree with the basic premises of Justice Brennan's famous Harvard Law Review article. The robust rights revolution of the Warren Court in the early Berger years had indeed produced an unintended consequence of an atrophy in state constitutional law, eclipsing the role of the state Supreme Courts. The state constitutions are distinct sources of law that invite authoritative interpretation by the state Supreme Courts. And it is unquestionably the duty of the state courts to mark the boundaries of separation of powers in state government and to give effect to the individual rights protections of the state constitutions. In the state courts, no less than in the federal, unexamined deference to the political branches abdicates that duty. For me, the more important and difficult question is how. By what decision method should the state judges adjudicate claims arising under the state constitution? On that question, I think it will probably come as no surprise to most of you that I part company with Justice Brennan's loose and evolutionary living constitution method of constitutional interpretation. In a nutshell, it does not constrain the judges to behave like judges and to actually do law. One example from my time on the Wisconsin Supreme Court will illustrate why, and this will segue into this morning's discussion of state education clause litigation. One of our most important cases during my very first year on the state Supreme Court involved a highly consequential question of state constitutional law. It was a challenge to the legislature's school finance formula, much like the challenges you heard about this morning in other states. The challenge was brought under the uniformity clause of the state constitution's education article. The education article is very short, and it simply directs the state legislature to establish a system of public schools free and open to all, and I'm quoting now, as uniform as practicable. My colleagues used this school finance formula case, Vincent versus Voigt is the name if you'd like to look it up, to announce an elaborate new fundamental right to a sound basic education. And they further define this right as an education that will equip students for their roles as citizens and enable them to succeed both economically and personally. There's more. My colleagues declared that the state constitutional right to a sound basic education includes, and I'm quoting again, the opportunity to be proficient in mathematics, science, reading and writing, geography and history, and to receive instruction, still quoting, in the arts and music, vocational training, social sciences, health, physical education, and foreign language. Yes, all of this was in the state constitution since 1848 when we achieved statehood, lurking there in the education article's uniformity clause, just waiting to be excavated by the state Supreme Court. Who knew? I dissented, distancing myself from this extravagant exercise in judicial invention, for that is indeed what it was. It was the product of the imagination of the education activists that brought the litigation. And my colleagues took the bait and made it all up. And I'm not speaking out of school here. I said all this in my dissent. So if you want more where that came from, you can go and read it. The newly declared constitutional right to a sound basic education, so defined as I've just indicated, did not derive from the education article's uniformity clause in any meaningful sense. Instead, my colleagues constitutionalized their own views of sound education policy. Now, we decided many other notable cases raising questions of state constitutional law during my five-year tenure on the state Supreme Court, including a challenge to the expansion of Indian gaming under the gambling provision, and two first impression cases interpreting the state constitution's right to keep and bear arms. The court did a little better job with these cases and hewed more closely to the constitutional text, history, and tradition. But my experience with that school finance case gave me serious cause for concern about my own court's approach to constitutional adjudication. Now, I've been out of the field of state constitutional law for quite a few years now, so I will turn the podium over to our experts. Justice Markman.
When she cited the expert, I wasn't quite sure who she was talking about, but I'm glad to be designated as such. This is a wonderful conference, and I'm honored to participate. It's inspiring to see so many people here who are interested in the subject of state constitutions and judicial federalism, and thus far it's been a wonderful conference, and but I admire your interest in the subject, and I appreciate the opportunity to serve with two such thoughtful people in the art and mechanics of the exercise of the judicial power as Judge Sykes and Judge Bolick. In an effort to maintain some semblance of a breathing state constitution in Michigan, The Supreme Court of our state has undertaken to do the following in recent years. First, where for many years the court had refused to answer certified questions from the federal courts, today we are more willing to do so. And what we do in responding to certified questions is to preserve the integrity of the laws and constitution of our state in circumstances in which a judicial body that is not part of our state is constitutionally obligated to apply the law of our state. Secondly, our court has been prepared to take issue with lower federal court decisions with which we disagreed, notably prevailing in the U.S. Supreme Court in the case of Burgeyes versus Smith, a Sixth Amendment jury dispute in which we engaged with the federal Sixth Circuit. Third, we at least have nominally maintained distinctive understandings of counterpart provisions of the Michigan and United States constitutions by decoupling their interpretations. Fourth, we have on many occasions accorded more detailed explanation of our criminal law decisions in an effort to preclude habeas corpus reversal of those decisions. Fifth, we have often cited as the basis for our decisions state constitutional provisions, even where those provisions were essentially duplicative of already cited federal provisions, in order to remind the bench and bar that the state charter might someday be restored to independent consequence. Sixth, we have cited our own case law and jurisprudence where we believe these to be useful in giving meaning to federal statutes that we were interpreting. And seventh, we have occasionally invited parties to opine as to whether a case or controversy before us might be resolved differently under counterpart federal and state constitutional provisions, either on the basis of variation in language or simply their distinctive provenance. Having undertaken all of these actions, however, it would be a considerable overstatement in my judgment to assert that either individually or in combination, these have contributed in some meaningful way to the revitalization of our state constitution or to judicial federalism. Just as in my estimation, ours is an era in which institutions of federalism are largely moribund, so in particular, I believe, are institutions of judicial federalism. And I have witnessed in my adulthood relatively little interest, much less passion, on the part of either political party in reviving these institutions. Governance by Washington, uniformity of public policy, and centralization today represent the norm. They represent that which is the default. They represent what is traditional in what seems to be compelled by the Constitution. And all of this is reinforced by our law school curriculums and the contemporary legal and judicial cultures. Neither the bench nor the bar in the country, at least in my observation, have appeared particularly interested in establishing state constitutional provisions as a meaningful alternative to their federal counterparts, even where one might have supposed that there was potential advantage to doing so in a particular case under a Brennan-esque theory of federalism. And in particular, the federal judiciary, including the United States Supreme Court, in whose hands rests the most significant influence concerning what our judicial equilibrium is to be, has shown relatively little interest in revisiting centralized decisions and doctrines of constitutional law or in restoring earlier aspects of the historical balance in state and federal judicial decision making, which at the same time is not at all to exonerate state judicial decision makers in this regard. Increasingly, for example, in the last few years, federal agencies of both Republican and Democratic administrations have employed their spending authority to impose conditions upon state courts that implicate areas of judicial policy that have historically lain at the heart of state court authority, such as child support and child custody policies and matters of courtroom administration, with almost no significant objection from those state courts. Most of all, however, what in my view has most stunted the development of state constitutional law in recent years has been the accelerated expansion of the 14th Amendment's Equal Protection and Due Process Clause. Equal protection and due process, period, I think have accounted for an enormous revolution in federal and state equilibrium in the judicial process. Not, I would emphasize, because any of the understandings of federal courts in those areas necessarily has been borne out as right or wrong, but because each of those clauses has conferred upon the federal judiciary broader jurisdiction over even the most parochial matters of state law, while effectively removing these same matters from the purview of the state judiciary, which, as you know, has a similar constitutional obligation to give faithful meaning to these clauses of the 14th Amendment. Thus, these two clauses have become the trumping provisions of the federal Constitution, enabling aggrieved parties routinely to invoke federal jurisdiction to challenge state legislative enactments, bypassing in the process traditional exercises of state judicial authority over state affairs. Concerning equal protection, as each new protected realm or category has been identified, as innovative notions of disparate impact arise as to what constitutes discrimination, and as traditional notions of deference to the decision-making of representative state institutions are supplanted in the name of the Constitution, the principal occupation of state legislatures, indeed of legislative bodies generally, enacting policies that differentiate between categories of persons, increasingly has been thwarted. And concerning due process, the substantive component of this command, the fundamental rights inquiries, the rational basis analyses, have had the potential to transform huge swaths of state legislative action into federal questions. Concerning then each of these clauses, while traditional constitutional forms have been maintained, the sheer enveloping breadth of these provisions and their susceptibility to ever more expansive and creative constitutional argumentation has, at least in my judgment, worked to retard the development or restoration of both state constitutional law and judicial federalism. At an earlier time, there was some greater sense that a federal question must not simply pertain to merely a consequential or interesting or significant case, but must bear at least some reasonable relationship to the exercise of federal responsibilities within a system of limited federal jurisdiction. But increasingly, there is a steady enlargement of federal constitution of state law. Yes, I am cognizant that the great majority of all cases and controversies still are resolved by state courts, but more and more, this appears to be a function of the interests and priorities of those on the federal bench, and less a function of any apparent constitutional barriers to the assertion of federal jurisdiction. In Michigan alone, in just the past couple of years, we have seen the federal constitutionalization of laws pertaining in our state to electoral recounts, criminal appeals, sentencing guidelines, straight ticket voting, electoral integrity laws, sex offender registration, the advertising of local adult businesses, juvenile sentencing, prisoner rights, employee pensions, welfare entitlements, emergency municipal manager laws, state legislative procedures, electoral redistricting, and of course, laws defining marriage. Indeed, there may well now be over 100 state laws in our state pertaining to marriage and its incidents that are in constitutional question, many of which will almost certainly be resolved in the years ahead in federal judicial forums, despite the nearly unchallenged autonomy that was once possessed by the state and the states and their judicial forums in matters of domestic affairs and domestic relationships. And it was recently made evident to me by a recent debate in which I participated at the Heritage Foundation concerning whether the U.S. Supreme Court should now revisit the Privileges or Immunities Clause of the 14th Amendment, that an even far more precipitous reduction in the role of states and their judiciaries looms. Breathing new life into that clause, as some 21st century constitutionalists and some libertarians would like to do, would accelerate even more rapidly the transformation of state legislative policies into the stuff of federal question jurisdiction. While disagreements remain among those who would like to resuscitate this clause of the 14th Amendment, it is a disagreement that extends only among those who believe that the provision guarantees welfare rights and those who instead believe that it guarantees positive rights or rights of equal treatment or redistributive rights or natural rights or distinctly personal rights or rights of equal standing or international human rights or economic rights or silent and unenumerated rights or fundamental rights and on and on and on. Each of which theories has in common the further empowerment of federal courts and the further disempowerment of state courts and state constitutions, except in the most trivial areas. Finally, let me not be the first to opine that I find little to celebrate today or 50 years ago in Justice Brennan's unidimensional federalism. There have not, in truth, been many occasions on which I have been enticed as a state justice by the opportunity to adopt constitutional interpretations that even Justice Brennan viewed as going beyond the boundaries of James Madison's Constitution or the Constitution intended by the framers. Nor do I believe that Justice Brennan's federalism has much at all to do with the great principle of representative and republican self-government that lay at the foundation of American federalism, nor does it have much of anything to do implicating the genuine distinctiveness of the states and their local cultures that underpins federalism. Justice Brennan's conversation with state courts has simply excluded constitutionally traditionalist perspectives, interpretivist or originalist perspectives, and Republican self-government perspectives, and also the perspectives of the great majority of we the people in states such as Michigan, who for well over a generation have placed judges of precisely those perspectives on the highest court of their state. I do genuinely look forward to the day, but do not pretend it will be soon, when the language of state constitutions will more routinely become a more relevant decision-making factor for state Supreme Courts. That day will not come until there has been some fundamental restoration and re-understanding of the 10th Amendment into our nation's constitutional jurisprudence. And I have thus far, regrettably, seen little evidence either that this is near or that it is indeed intended and desired by many. Thank you very much.
Good afternoon. I'm actually a bit nervous starting out here because my son, Ryan, who is studying Mandarin, has challenged me to greet you all in Mandarin. So here goes, Xin Yin Kuai La. Did I do okay? Today is the Chinese New Year, and I have just wished you a Happy New Year. And that is the last time I will ever speak to people in public in Mandarin. I'm also about to trip over the next four words of my presentation. I've been practicing these four words for weeks, and I just have not been able to get them to roll off my tongue. And I'm going to try one more time with some trepidation and begin by saying, Justice Brennan was right. Oh my gosh, I got it out. I can't believe it. I believe that Justice Brennan's message 50 years ago, and I'm of course being facetious, there are a number of occasions in which I agree with Justice Brennan. He was one of the great legal strategists of the 20th century, one of the most consequential justices in the history of our country, not even often, in a way that I would have liked to have seen, but one of the most incredibly insightful people ever to serve on the court. And his Law Review article 50 years ago was intended to be a clarion call to liberal judicial activists who were running out of steam in the federal courts. But his arguments then are even more salient, in my view, for libertarians and conservatives today, for a number of reasons. First of all, like the United States Supreme Court, state constitutions, by and large, are freedom charters. And that is probably no longer true of the encyclopedic California Constitution, but I think that if you look really, really carefully, you will still find some of those freedom provisions are just surrounded by a whole bunch of positive law. And even though Brennan described himself as a devout believer in federalism, we really are devout believers in federalism. And as such, it seems to me that that focusing on state constitutions is a natural evolution of our thought. I think it is also a particularly timely message for those of us who are interested in vindicating the freedom provisions of constitutions. For we may very well be experiencing our own Brennan moment. Certainly for the last 25 years on the United States Supreme Court, since the appointment of Justice Clarence Thomas, created a fairly working majority on the court. We've had good years in many areas of the law, private property rights, political speech, federalism, limits on the commerce power of Congress, and so forth. But of late, it seems that freedom advocates are playing defense rather than offense much more than in recent years. Even if we have a solid replacement for Justice Scalia, and of course there is no replacing Justice Scalia, the court already often goes 5-4 on many of the issues in which we've experienced the greatest success in recent years, most recently last year, the issue of racial preferences. But even if we have a very strong United States Supreme Court, state constitutions ultimately provide for greater prospects for freedom than the US Constitution, precisely because they were intended to do just that. Earlier this morning, you heard a number of relative advantages that state constitutions offer for advocates of freedom. I summarize them as the Fabulous Five of features of state constitutions, and I'll go through them very rapidly. First of all, they include protections unknown to the United States Constitution. For example, if we had an anti-gift clause in the United States Constitution, perhaps, or a private or local bill clause in the United States Constitution, perhaps we would not have seen the massive subsidies, the bridges to nowhere, and those sorts of things that are common in the federal budget. And there's many more provisions as well, many of them common to many state constitutions. Secondly, many similar provisions in state constitutions are written differently than the provisions in the federal constitution, and even those that were identically written can be interpreted to be more protective of freedom than the US Constitution, not less. I call that a freedom ratchet, properly understood. Third, state courts are generally the final word in the interpretation of state constitutions unless they are held to conflict with federal law. Fourth, there is far greater access to state courts. One thing that I don't think was mentioned this morning, and it's enormously important, is that many state courts recognize taxpayer standing to challenge violations of government power. And as Paul Avalar mentioned, no case or controversy requirement in many state constitutions. And finally, they're more easily amended. A number of rather trivial examples were given, but some very important things have happened to the organic law in our states recently in Arizona. For example, we have the idea of medical autonomy, your right to choose a doctor, your right to control the provision of your own health, made as part of our state constitution in anticipation that those rights may be jeopardized by the federal government as well as the state government. A restriction on racial preferences in our constitution as well as several others, including Michigan. And most recently, right to access experimental medications for people who are terminally ill, which interestingly, as that idea has spread now to over half of the states, including California, the FTC has basically retreated on the issue. So I think that this is very important. In terms of how one interprets state constitutions, this is an area that I think is ripe for greater scholarship. A number of ideas were talked about this morning. I personally emphatically reject the lockstep doctrine. As a textualist, I look at the words of our state constitution in Arizona afresh. Without any bias from how the United States Supreme Court has interpreted similar provisions there. Now, certainly if history comes into play, if the history is common in the two provisions, the federal constitution and the state constitution, it's certainly relevant to look at what the history of the federal provision is as well. But it seems to me that when federal courts have departed from the text and intent of the federal constitution, there is no obligation on the part of state judges to go along with that. Quite the contrary. We take an oath to both the U.S. Constitution and to our respective state constitutions, and I believe it is our duty to interpret our state constitution in accord with the words and intended meaning, rather than what the United States Supreme Court may have done to amend the U.S. Constitution over the years. A good example was given this morning, and that is the words public use appear in the eminent domain provisions of the U.S. Constitution and many state constitutions. The fact that the U.S. Supreme Court has basically amended that language to be public benefit rather than public use should not dictate to state courts that they should do the same thing, quite the contrary. If there are clauses in our Constitution that do not share a common heritage with the federal Constitution, how do we interpret those? Well, again, I think from a textualist standpoint, you try your best to understand what the words mean and to faithfully implement them. And by the way, that does emphatically go for positive rights as well. If they are part of our organic law, we are bound to interpret them even and apply them, even if we may personally disagree with them. If the meaning is ambiguous, how do you go about interpreting them? In Arizona, that presents us with a real quandary on many occasions because we have almost no constitutional history at all. You go to the records of the Constitution in Arizona, and they are very, very sparse, to put it mildly. So oftentimes we have to turn to similar provisions in other states from which these provisions were borrowed. And again, I think it appropriate to look at the purpose and intent of those provisions, but not necessarily at the subsequent jurisprudence. We assume we share a common purpose, and the gift clause is a good example of that. It was aimed at preventing subsidies in the time Arizona was settled. To railroad companies that would make grandiose promises of building a railroad and then after receiving public funds would go belly up. And the gift clause was designed to prevent exactly that, and I'm happy to say that, by and large, the Arizona Supreme Court in recent years has been faithful to that interpretation. Ultimately, of course, the role of every judge, in my view, is to give effect to every word in the Constitution and not simply to assume that it's been blotted out by time. At the end of the day, state constitutions are the frontiers for freedom. But state court judges cannot decide cases that are not brought. And I really do believe that this is on the lawyers. I don't believe that most lawsuits that don't raise independent state grounds are done because the lawyer has sat there and said, you know what, there's just nothing there. They don't think of it. And when they do think of it, it's simply to say, oh, the First Amendment and this article of the Arizona Constitution or whatever state constitution, with no independent analysis whatsoever in terms of the independent vitality of the state constitution. I have been in cases that I have written repeatedly saying no state constitutional grounds were alleged. Hopefully the message will get out there that, guess what, you just lost this case. May have been a little different if you had alleged this, an independent state constitutional ground. I don't know, but we certainly can't know unless it's brought and litigated. So to each and every one of you, and this is a message that I give to every audience in which I speak, liberal, conservative, or agnostic, don't let state constitutions be an afterthought. Make them a forethought. Blaze some trails. Constitutional protections are mere verbiage until they are given life by lawyers and judges. Thank you very much.
All right, there you have it. I think the battle lines are drawn. We have an optimistic enthusiast and we have a non-enthusiast. That's what we'll call it. I'm going with that. I'd like to take the opportunity to ask the first question about the lockstep or non-lockstep method. I think the most obvious object of Justice Brennan's famous Law Review article in the Harvard Law Review was to challenge the state judiciaries not to interpret their state constitution's Declaration of Rights in lockstep with the U.S. Supreme Court's interpretation of the cognate provisions in the Bill of Rights of the federal constitution, because, of course, the Warren Court's project of living constitutionalism had stalled, and now he was challenging the state Supreme Courts to carry it on. And Chief Justice Markman, you mentioned that the Michigan Supreme Court has started to embark on a project of decoupling, and I wonder if you could give us an example or two and explain the methodology that you use to do that, and then I'll ask the same question. I know what your position is on how it should be done, but I'd like to know your court's position.
Yes, so we have decoupled or de-lockstepped a number of our constitutional provisions, and the whole premise is simply, of course, that state judges are no more permitted to let federal judges define state law for them than to allow law professors or plumbers or mechanics or anybody else to define the law for them. They have an obligation to read the Constitution and to attempt to understand what it means. And let me say, if I can just diverge just a little bit here, I think it was Professor Miller who in some very thoughtful remarks said that state courts were somewhat, I'm putting words in his mouth perhaps, but they were somewhat derelict in not enforcing state bills of rights prior to the area in which the federal government started getting involved in that as a function of the incorporation doctrine. I know in the state of Michigan, there were quite a number of decisions interpreting our Bill of Rights prior to the 1920s and 1930s. But what's significant, and there weren't a lot, but there were some. But to me, what's critical there is that I don't recall during the 19th century that there was any history of censorship in Michigan, or newspapers being shut down by local sheriffs, or people jailed for supporting unpopular candidates, or roving truth squads, or anything generally that seemed to be incompatible with how we understand the First Amendment today. I think the premise of state courts at that point, when they were dominant in terms of giving meaning to these constitutional provisions through the vehicle of state constitutions, was that all local and municipal officials took an oath to the Constitution. They all could read and see what those provisions said. And if they said there shall be no interference with free speech, they could understand what those words meant, since our constitutional provisions, just like the federal constitutional provisions, were not written for the bench and bar. They were written for a free, self-governing people. And most significantly, the people of the state of Michigan during 1820 and 1830 and 1860 and 1910 and 1920 were not very much disposed to interfere with free speech, because these were the values of the people. That's how these constitutional provisions developed. So the fact that there might not have been a lot of decisions is kind of irrelevant to me. What is relevant is, did we have an environment in Michigan during the 19th century in which First Amendment and free speech rights were being run over roughshod? Or were there other ways and vehicles and means and procedures by which people came to respect their constitution, and their governing officials were able to understand those values, and they themselves had no interest in undermining those values?
All right, thank you. We know that you're emphatically in opposition to lockstep. Where is the rest of your court, and can you give any examples?
Well, I can give you a couple of examples, and I think by and large it really is a case-by-case basis, but I don't think the Arizona Supreme Court compared to, say, the Illinois Supreme Court, which at least as of a few years ago was, it wasn't a pejorative term, it was a self-described term of being a lockstep jurisdiction. We've never really embraced the lockstep doctrine overtly, but there's two examples that came to mind. One was alluded to by Paul Avalar this morning. At the very, very same time as the U.S. Supreme Court was deciding the Kelo decision adversely, we had a case involving that I was honored to litigate involving a guy named Randy Bailey, who had a brake shop at the corner of Mesa and Country Club, Main and Country Club in Mesa, and the city of Mesa, in its wisdom, decided that they wanted a much more pizzazzy street corner there, and so they were going to replace the brake shop with a hardware store, and gave it a subsidy on top of that. And we went to court and lost in a trial court that applied the U.S. jurisprudence. But then we went up the appellate ladder and ultimately won with the Arizona courts basically saying, sorry, we've got far greater protections here, and I'm really happy. And by the way, if your brakes go out on you in Mesa, you can still get brakes at Randy's brake shop service. Another one more recently was, and I'm sure Chief Justice Markman knows this all too well, but a lot of our decisions emanate from Supreme Court decisions that basically force us to do certain things. And one area in which that's the case is in the area of punishment of juvenile murderers. The U.S. Supreme Court has decided that the Eighth Amendment protects against cruel or unusual punishment, not and. And in the area of juvenile punishment, the death penalty was abolished many years ago. More recently, in a pair of cases, the U.S. Supreme Court has said you can't give them lifetime sentences without possibility of parole, without an independent litigation or process to make that determination that they are permanently corrupted. And Justice Kennedy, in the most recent decision, went on to say, and it is our instinct that the vast majority of juvenile murderers, he used the word offenders, but they are all murderers, are not permanently corrupted. And we had to apply that decision, overturn a whole bunch of convictions. And I took the opportunity to write a concurring opinion in which I said, this is, all of this prediction is a bunch of dicta, and our court should apply this on a case-by-case basis, not with any thumb on the scale that you're supposed to decide against life without parole. And I hope, I'm still a rookie on the court, so we'll see whether it has any impact, but I do think that unless the Supreme Court forces us to do something, we should apply our independent judgment.
All right, thank you. Okay. We'll go to questions, and while you're raising your hand and the microphone is finding you, I will give an example from the Wisconsin experience, and that is in the area of religious liberty, and in particular free exercise jurisprudence. As you all know, the Supreme Court, in a famous decision by Justice Scalia, the Smith decision, held that there are no religious accommodations available against laws of general applicability, a Smith case, very controversial, led to RFRA and RLUIPA. My court, in a decision issued a year or two before I joined it, and we are not a full lockstep or the opposite, we're a hybrid jurisdiction. And in this case, the religion clause in the State Declaration of Rights in the state constitution contains much more robust language, and the court looked to the text of the religion clause in the state constitution and its history and the way it had been interpreted through 150 years of state history, and did not adopt the Smith Doctrine for the state of Wisconsin and its free exercise clause. It was, the fact pattern was interesting. It was a case brought by the Amish. God bless the Amish for bringing all these cases. They objected to a law of general applicability that required that oversized vehicles put one of those triangular warning signs on the back, and they refused to put it on their buggies. And they were cited, and they took it all the way up to the state Supreme Court, and the state Supreme Court said, you get a religious accommodation under the state constitution. So that's an example of how this new judicial federalism properly understood and applied and linked to constitutional text, history, and tradition is on the right side of constitutional interpretation, at least as far as I'm concerned. So, all right, with that, do we have questions? Yes, we have a hand in the back. The lady who got the red memo.
The first part of my question, I just invite your comments if you do have any. We have a heavy-handed push here in California to have a Bill of Rights for Children set up. And there's a concern that this Bill of Rights for Children may take away some rights from parents. So if you have comments, I do welcome them. But my real question is, in your experience as to Bill of Rights, both state and federal, do you feel that in enumerating them, we are then limited to finding rights in the penumbra of what has been enumerated? Or do you feel that these Bill of Rights are essential to safeguarding key rights, so sometimes it's worth limiting rights that are not enumerated?
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Wow.
So take that first. We have a general question and then children's rights. Go ahead, Chief Justice.
Well, let me give the non-enthusiastic view of things again, if I can. I don't quarrel with the description at all, but it is what it is, I suppose. What you're saying really does implicate this whole decoupling doctrine. As I indicated, in Michigan, we have basically tried to decouple where we could. My only point is not that this is not a good thing to do where you can, but it just doesn't have much impact, because the fundamental disagreement that I have with Clint, who is, I think, a great scholar of the law, and I admire him very much, the disagreement we have is not over individual liberty. I believe I'm quite committed to that. It's not the idea that we want to limit government. It's what do we want to do about the exercise of the judicial power? There are good rights and there are bad rights that can be engaged in by a court that decouples, but they can only go in the direction that Justice Brennan sees fit to allow them to go. And my concern as a conservative
is that we limit the role of the judiciary, which has gotten way out of hand over the past generation, couple generations, in deciding a broader and broader array of issues that I believe the framers under our Constitution left for we the people in the exercise of their representative authority. So to the extent I disagree with Clint, Judge Bolick, it's merely, it's not that some of the rights he talks about are not admirable. I too think it's ridiculous that we have state and local regulation of braiding as best as I understand it. Do I think it's unconstitutional? Do I think that local communities can't make those kinds of judgments, even though I happen to disagree with them and think that they're excessive exercises of government? I don't know that everything that I dislike is unconstitutional, and I don't know that I ought to be the adult supervisor for the people in directing them as to what kinds of local regulations and exercises of authority they can engage in, even when I think they are badly misguided, as I do in the case of regulating eyebrow braiding, again, as best as I understand it.
Justice Bolick.
Well, first of all, on the parental rights versus, great questions, by the way, versus children's rights, you do have to keep in mind that ultimately the 14th Amendment was to safeguard individual rights against violation by state governments. And that may be, you know, we're talking about this very much in the abstract, but the U.S. Supreme Court, and this is an issue that divided Justice Thomas and Justice Scalia, have recognized parental rights under the Due Process Clause of the U.S. Constitution. And if a state were to go too far in trenching upon those rights, there could be a federal remedy, and that could be quite appropriate. Chief Justice Markman and I do have a significant disagreement in terms of what you do when you have a constitutional provision that appears to be important, but has been completely eviscerated in the Constitution, and that is, of course, the Privileges or Immunities Clause of the 14th Amendment. One would think that it was meant to be significant, given that it is first, even before equal protection and due process, and it's the only provision in the 14th Amendment that by its terms protects something substantive in the manner of rights that are protected. And it turns out, when you look at the history of it, that it had a very, very clear meaning. In fact, privileges or immunities at the time of the adoption of the 14th Amendment was a term as common as life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness is today. The reason it's not common anymore is because the slaughterhouse cases ripped it right out of the Constitution. It does mean something. Fortunately, scholarship indicates that two of the protections intended to protect was to incorporate the Bill of Rights against the states, which was then done in a tortured manner and in a selective manner, but also economic liberties, to constitutionalize the rights protected in the Civil Rights Act of 1866. And while I totally credit the danger that Chief Justice Markman articulates very well in having the judiciary enforce those rights, to me, the far greater danger is not enforcing something that was in the Constitution, and that is why eyebrow threaders and people who work on horses' hooves and that sort of thing are outlaws in many states rather than gainfully employed and in the mainstream economy.
All right, we have time for one more question. Yes, sir.
It's a lot of pressure, the last question. So I hope this doesn't call for a narrative, but my question is, when I don't get to talk to people serving on Supreme Courts, the highest court in the land, and I was curious to just get your views on how you consider stare decisis when you're encountering a decision that you think was clearly wrongly decided, but theoretically you're somewhat bound by the precedent. How do you view it? Does it matter whether it's a constitutional question or a statutory interpretation question? And what's your thought process? Is it sort of de novo review? Is it, if it's clearly erroneous, how do you think about it?
Great question. Doctrine of stare decisis.
Well, that's one of the most difficult questions, I believe, that a judge has to grapple with. There's obviously a great tension between respect for stare decisis or precedent and the need to try to interpret the Constitution or statutes correctly, and they often come into tension. On the one hand, I take an oath to the law and the Constitution, not to the decisions of my predecessor. I understand that. At the same time, I don't believe that any legal system, state, federal, local, I don't believe that any legal system can operate responsibly if every time there's a change in the court, if every time another case comes up, there's no effort to try to retain the continuity and stability that stare decisis and precedent bring to the system. So I guess I'm not giving an answer so much as suggesting the kind of considerations, but I think when there's an argument that the law has been, or the Constitution has been misinterpreted over a period of time, you have no choice but to look to a variety of factors to see whether or not those mistakes, those errors, are correctable by any other means, and just how expectations have been legitimized and institutionalized over the year in that, over the years in that jurisdiction, to try to determine what the most responsible and appropriate response is in balancing these very difficult considerations.
Justice Bonner.
I find myself in agreement with Chief Justice Markman. I would add a few things. Constitutional error is very difficult to correct except by the judiciary. And so I think that I would be far more inclined to ignore precedent if it is clearly contrary to the text of the Constitution. And I suspect there are a number of cases coming our way that may present that very question. In the statutory, and there would be an exception to that, as Chief Justice Markman said, if a liberty has been recognized and basically our society relies on that liberty now, I would be less inclined to overturn the precedent, even if I disagreed with it. On the statutory side, it is a little less. Stare decisis, I think, has greater weight, particularly if the legislature has had an opportunity to revisit the legislation that's been interpreted and change it if we've gotten it wrong. So in that context, I think that is referred to as legislative ratification, which I think is overstated in a number of instances, but I do think that's where stare decisis has its greater weight.
All right, we're out of time, but just in closing on the subject of stare decisis, I'll share with you something that Justice Thomas said a few years back when I had the honor of interviewing him at Federalist Society National Conference after the banquet. And one of the questions I asked him was, Justice Thomas, stare decisis doesn't hold much force for you, does it? And he looked at me and he said, oh, it does, just not enough to keep me from going to the Constitution. Thank you.
Thank you.